The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I'm your host today, Jody Green, with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and today we have a special guest in real life in the same room as me. It's super weird. So I'm pretty excited to have our special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Kate Chapman. I'm an extension educator of urban entomology with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, which might sound like deja vu a little bit.
It is a little deja vu, and I just want to tell you in real life and in audio that I appreciate you and I love working with you, and it's so great that we can actually work together in person.
I know. Thank you, Jody. Likewise, you know, I don't know what I would do without you. It's nice that we share the same passion and same struggles at the same time, so it's great.
True. So I've been an urban entomologist for a long time, and you're kind of a new but excellent urban entomologist just kind of starting out. So you must have this amazing background in something, because you are not only delightful, but you are so sharp and smart, and you're so good at science communication and all that you do. Even though we've worked together for a little bit here, I don't really know a lot about you and what your background is, so I think this would make a great podcast. How did you become what you are? Would you call yourself an urban entomologist?
I honestly don't. I don't think so yet.
Okay, but that's your title.
I'm getting there. It's my work title, but, you know, deep inside, like, I'm an entomologist. Am I an urban entomologist? That's a mystery yet. Maybe, like, 10 years from now in this job, I'll be like, okay, I guess I can consider myself that. But so my background is actually in plant biochemistry and how that relates to aphids and host plant resistance to aphids. So all of my graduate work revolved around aphids, a little bit of caterpillars here and there, but it was host plant resistance. So,
and that's really cool, because we have not had a lot of guests or podcast episodes about that, and it's very important now that I do, I guess, garden pests, and people ask all sorts of things, because urban pests are everywhere and urban environments have other types of pests. So we do answer questions a lot about, like, oh yeah, those are aphids. But that's basically all I know. Like, I kind of know when a plant has aphids. Do you love aphids?
I do. I think it's like, you know, in grad school, you're so focused on an experiment, and oh, I feel like half of my experiments were counting aphids. So I would spend 12 hours a day counting aphids. I would go home, fall asleep, and I would dream of counting aphids. So, like, you kind of hate them, but at the same time, like, your whole world revolves around aphids, and they're pretty cute as far as insects go.
What makes an aphid an aphid?
So an aphid is a really small, piercing-sucking hemipteran. So it's in the order Hemiptera, and all aphids are in their own family called Aphididae. But they're really small, piercing-sucking insects that feed on plants.
Are they in the true bugs?
They're not. So true bugs are their own suborder. And, you know, I'm not sure I'm up to date on, like, the correct, because taxonomy is constantly changing. So true bugs are their own suborder. They're usually classified by, like, the Hemelytra wings when present. But no, so aphids are in the suborder that's, like, plant parasitic bugs, essentially.
Okay. If it's got cornicles, it's aphids?
Yeah. So, to my knowledge, aphids are the only insects that possess cornicles, and it's kind of like the diagnostic character.
What are cornicles?
Cornicles. Well, first of all, like, cornicles is a lovely word, right? It just rolls off the tongue. We're the corn huskers, so cornicles, oh. Right? So cornicles are like the aphid tailpipes. They're these, like, little tubes on the back of the aphid, like the abdomen. There's two of them. And they pretty much just secrete, like, defensive compounds. One of the most, like, notable is the aphid alarm pheromone. Oh. So let's say a ladybug comes along, wants to snack on some aphids. Aphids are like, hey, that's not cool. Stop eating my sisters. They'll secrete this pheromone out of these cornicles, the tailpipes. The other aphids will pick up the scent and be like, hey, I'm just going to drop off this leaf and run away. And so it's kind of cool if you look up, like, lab videos from when they figured this out. They'll just put, like, a little droplet in aphids, and they'll just, like, plop right off the leaf.
But then do they die when they fall off the leaf?
Nope, they'll eventually make their way back to the plant. You know, aphids, or insects in general, they can take a good fall and generally be okay.
Oh. I always associate honeydew with aphids. So the honeydew doesn't come out of the tailpipes.
No, the honeydew is... Can I say poop?
You can say whatever you want.
So the honeydew is the equivalent of aphid poop. So it comes out the back end, but not the cornicles.
Okay. And that's just their, like, poo. So that's, like, because they eat, because they're sucking the sap, and so they poop out
the sugar. So aphids eat plant sap, which, as you can imagine, is, like, really high in sucrose and sugars, and not all of it gets digested. So they just secrete this liquid honeydew, which is, like, pretty much pure sugar, which other insects love to eat, like ants.
So the ants don't eat the aphids. They eat the honeydew.
Correct.
But there are a lot of predators of aphids.
Correct.
But there are a lot of aphids.
Yes. It's its own little ecosystem that revolves around aphids, which is why it's so wonderful.
Do you have a favorite aphid?
Oh, that's a loaded question.
How many aphids are there?
You know, I looked this up earlier because I was like, I know there's at least like a couple hundred in the United States, but according to Wikipedia, which I know is not a reliable educational source, but worldwide it's estimated there's around 5,000 different species of aphid. And it's a lot.
It is.
They're really hard, like, unless you have the most wonderful microscope in the whole world, it's really hard to identify aphids down to species, which is why if you know, like, what plant it's on, really helps narrow it down. Because a lot of aphids are really specific to either a species of plant or a family of plants, while there's some aphids that are like, I don't really care what plant it is, I'm just hungry. Like, the green peach aphid eats a lot of different things.
Does it eat peach?
It does.
Is it green?
It is. I was going to make some joke, like, the green peach aphid named after the illustrious Jody Green. But, you know.
Cabbage? Is it cabbage aphid?
So, green peach aphid is not a cabbage aphid, but they both feed on brassica plants like cabbage. I actually did some research on both of these. Because the green peach aphid is a generalist. It feeds on many different families of plants. While the cabbage aphid, because it only feeds on brassica plants, we consider a specialist. It has a limited host range. And so part of, like, my graduate research was, okay, let's see if the plant responds differently to a generalist and a specialist. And they do.
What do you mean?
So I
like
looked,
the plant responding. It's like, ow, don't.
So
stop
my research,
poking me.
It does, though. That's okay. How plants respond. It's like the human immune system responds to, like, a mosquito bite. Plants will respond to insects feeding on it. And so I looked at mostly, like, plant hormones. So kind of a generalization is if a caterpillar chews on this one type of plant, the plant will be like, hey, I'm going to send out jasmonic acid because that's going to make me more resistant to caterpillars. But if an aphid feeds on the same type of plant, an aphid doesn't chew, has a piercing, sucking mouth part, jasmonic acid isn't going to do anything. So instead it's like, oh, here's an aphid. Instead I'm going to send out salicylic acid. So like the plant
do?
Is really smart. It recognizes what's feeding on it. And so salicylic acid makes it more resistant to piercing, sucking insects like aphids. And so I kind of looked at that from a generalist, specialist standpoint. Like, does it matter? Like, can the plant recognize what type of aphid it is? And is it going to respond differently? And it can. It's really, like...
And this was your master's, PhD project?
Master/PhD. Kind of all blends together.
So was it, like, a lot of field work, or was it, it's mostly lab
all
work
All lab
then?
Work.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do you find the aphids? Like, how did you choose your aphid that you were going to work on if there's 5,000?
So the first part of my degree was soybean aphid, and that's because it's economically important. You know, Nebraska grows a lot of soybeans. Soybean aphid's not a huge problem in the state, but, you know, around the world, it is a huge problem, and so that's why we chose soybean aphid.
Is it, like, one of the number one pests? Because, like, soybean is
Of soybean, okay. Yes. It can be. I mean, there's obviously, like, new emerging pests, like gall midge, which mm-hmm. kind of are a little more severe, in my opinion. But mm-hmm. we chose green PJ fid because I worked on the plant Arabidopsis thaliana, which, if you're not familiar with it, it is a plant. It's pretty much a weed that's had its whole genome sequenced, so you can make mutations of it really easily. You can mutate a single gene in Arabidopsis and grow that plant. And so we chose green peach aphid and cabbage aphid because they feed on that.
Oh.
If that kind of makes sense.
So then you work backwards?
Yeah. Kind of, right? So we make these mutations. Like, I silenced this one gene that produces this one hormone, and now I want to see if it kills aphids or not.
Can you even explain what that means?
I mean, without getting, like, too technical. But, you know, like, we have genes. When you think about, you know, in the urban sense, like, bed bug bites. Like, some people, when they get bit by a bed bug, they have a really severe reaction.
Yeah,
have,
me, hives. I'm going to point to myself.
Yes, like Jody. Other people, like, they probably don't even realize they were bit. Like, they have a different genetic structure, and they're going to react differently, and it's the same thing with plants. They can have a different genetic structure. So that's, like, different cultivars of plants. So when you're, like, planting in your garden,
so is
things
it
like that.
Like, when we tell people, like, well, you should plant a more resistant variety,
exactly.
It's because the people who know about plants know that they're not as susceptible or more tolerant to certain feeders?
Exactly. So that's from a genetic standpoint. These people, plant breeders, have bred plants to be more resistant to insects, to be more resistant to certain, like, disease, and that all just goes back to genetics. And so I kind of worked from, like, the basal laboratory setting, and, you know, if what I did worked, then it could go to the breeder to, yeah. Like, a GMO standpoint type thing.
So you knew you were turning certain things off, and then we were waiting to see what happened with the plant or with the aphid?
Both. So when we think about host plant resistance, which is what I worked on, fundamentally there's three different types of resistance. There's antibiotic, so the aphid feeds on the plant, something in the plant kills the aphid. So it's killing life, antibiotic, so it's killing the aphid. There's anti-zoonotic, so aphid feeds on the plant, decides, like, hey, this tastes pretty bad. It's going to go somewhere else. So it's changing the behavior of the aphid. And then the third type is tolerance, which in itself is a lot more complicated because, you know, the hypothesis is tolerance doesn't rely on a single gene. It's a mix, like, it's so much more complicated. But tolerance is where the aphid will feed on the plant, like, hey, it's pretty good, it's not killing me, I'll stay here, you know, reproduce. We're going to make a lot of aphids. But the plant can tolerate it. Like, it's not going to start wilting or yellowing. Whereas compared to a susceptible plant that has the same number of aphids, it's like, oh, this, I'm not feeling well. And then the aphids start to kill the plant. Tolerant plants can withstand that. And, you know, in the realm of agriculture, we think of, like, that's pretty good. It's not going to change our
harvest
yield.
And yield.
We're not going to have to invest in, you know, pesticides, because we know this plant is tolerant. And most importantly, like, why tolerance is important is because it hypothetically, theoretically, will not put selection pressure on the aphids. So just like with antibiotic, where you're killing the aphids, it can put selection pressure just like with pesticides. And that's where you get resistance popping up. Green peach aphid, going back to that,
mm-hmm.
I forgot the number off the top of my head, but it's like the insect that is resistant to the highest number of active ingredients of all other insects. Like, most instances of documented resistance, followed by the German cockroach, I believe. But you think about, like, aphids make so many babies so fast.
Yeah, like, let's talk about that.
Yeah,
do they poop out
pressure?
Babies? Because sometimes I, like, I'm staring at aphids and it looks like they're pooping out babies. And I'm like, no, they poop out honeydew.
Yes, they poop out honeydew, but aphids can either lay eggs or give live birth. They have a really complicated life cycle, depending on what aphid it is.
So it depends on the aphid? Or is it, like, is it like social insects where it's like it depends what they need? Are they called a colony? Because they like hang out a
lot.
They
are colonies, but they're not technically social because they don't have jobs. They just eat.
Okay, so there's not a caste system.
No.
They're just a bunch of suckers.
There's just a lot of them.
Sucking, doing aphid things together, pooping honeydew. Aphids being aphids.
Part of my graduate research is I wanted to see how these different cultivars or different genotypes of plants, so different genetic backgrounds of the same plant, how it affected aphid behavior. And one of the ways we measure that is through what we call electrical penetration graph. And it's like whoever came up with this is like crazy. I couldn't come up with that ever. But pretty much what you do is you have a plant in a pot. You put this metal rod in the pot that's hooked up to a wire. And so that's the plant end of the system. Then you glue this really tiny, fine gold wire onto the back of an aphid. It is a skill.
No.
It is on
aphids are like, small, like I don't even know what size that is. And then you're gluing is it gold? Like true
it's,
gold?
Like a gold wire. It's
like 10 karat gold?
Really tiny.
14 karat gold?
I don't know.
Where do you get these gold wires from? What kind of glue do you use?
We actually use a glue with silver in it.
Silver and gold?
Yeah, silver. I mean,
this is a high dollar
aphid. If you're gonna be an aphid, be a rich aphid, right? But yes, you use silver glue so it still conducts. But you glue it onto the back of the aphid. It takes skill. You have to put the aphid in the fridge. It takes a lot of skill. I've dissected salivary glands out of chinch bugs before. Like,
you are amazing.
I was not good at it by any means. But yeah, gluing a little wire on the back of the aphid. And so that wire completes the circuit from the plant to the aphid. And so what happens is the aphid is on the leaf, on this like little wire bungee cord thing. And when it starts feeding, it creates a pattern of waveforms. And those waveforms actually correlate to where the insect's mouth parts are in the plant. So we can see when an aphid, because it's got a piercing, sucking mouth part, we can see the moment it pierces a cell.
In the waves?
In the waves, yep.
Where do you see these waves?
Like so on a computer. So it's hooked up to this whole system. And so, like, wow, it's piercing a cell. I can tell that this aphid is looking for the phloem. And so it goes between the cells on the plant surface, and it'll pierce every cell on its way down until it finds that phloem, which is the plant sap, which is what they're looking for. And so I can tell how long it takes them to get to the phloem. I can tell how many times they've probed for the phloem, and I can compare that between susceptible and resistant plants. So it's like looking at how the plant affects the aphid behavior, but on a very micro scale.
So is it different wave patterns from?
Yes.
Okay.
So if it's in the phloem, it'll have its own wave pattern. If it's in the xylem, which is the water system of the plant, sometimes they'll feed on just the water. It's not like a full-time thing. They always want the phloem. You know, it's just, sometimes you get thirsty. There's a different waveform for the xylem. If there's no waveform, that means the aphid's just hanging out. It's not trying to eat.
It's just probing for no reason?
Well, sometimes it'll just, like, hang out on the plant. Like, so maybe the plant, it didn't like it. Like, the anti-zoonosis, so it's just going to hang out. And we can tell, like, oh, this aphid didn't probe very long. It was only in the phloem for 5 minutes compared to they will stay in the phloem for hours. So maybe this plant is more resistant because the aphid's behavior is like that. So it comes out with all these waveforms. And then as a scientist, you spend hours upon hours going through. Because each replication is one aphid for 8 hours long. So you spend...
like that's a whole workday.
Hours of your time going through these different waveforms, trying to tell what the aphid is.
Just for one aphid? And then how many times do you replicate that?
So our system that we had, we could do 8 replications. At one day, one given time.
Is it like...
we could do 8 plants. Wow. But like, who thought of this? Seriously, like who thought, I'm going to put an aphid and a plant on the same circuit and look at the waveforms it makes. And then like looking at the different waveforms. And so this is if I recall correctly, what they did when they were first figuring this out is, like, determine where the aphid was for this waveform. Like, a new waveform just popped up. Like, where is it in the cell? They would flash freeze the aphid, cut off its head, do, like, finally slice this plant and see where the stylet parts were. Like, who comes up with this? Like, maybe I can't be a research professor because I am not that ingenious, innovative. But now we know what each waveform means, so all I have to do is go through the waveforms.
Is hook them up.
Right.
And analyze it.
Yes. The hardest part about working with aphids is that you never get aphids where you want them, and then wherever you don't want aphids, they show up. Like working in a greenhouse, like growing up your plants for an experiment. Like, hey, you're not supposed to be on this plant right now. Now I got to restart the whole planting process.
Like, where would it go?
In a greenhouse, you know, you're doing an experiment there. Maybe there were some aphids left over from your last experiment that you missed.
Oh.
And now they're on your new plants when you don't want them on your new plants because you need, like, fresh, virgin plants for this experiment. So then you got to replant the whole thing. And then a lot of times with, like, cabbage aphids are really finicky. You know, I'll infest, like, 10 aphids per plant. I'll come the next day and there's, like, 0 aphids. And then you got to try all over again.
Oh.
Having 0 aphids across the board, like, that's not data.
How do you know that they're not going to, like, clone themselves and do that on your plant during your experiment?
Well, during the experiment, we want them to reproduce.
Oh, okay.
Because I want to see, like, are they reproducing or are they dying off because the plant's killing them?
How's the plant killing them?
The antibiotic thing. Like, the single gene is producing a protein.
And then could you see that in the waves? Like, could you see them, like, this is not going well for the aphid? So it's like a, like, bleep,
yeah.
Bleep.
So if you see bleep. An aphid probing a lot, and then it's, like, in the phloem, and it's only there for, like, 5 minutes, and then it pulls out, it's like that plant is probably either, one, it doesn't taste good, or one, it's not feeling good. We can't tell the difference just from that EPG, but that's what these, like, follow-up tests are for.
That's so wild and crazy. I tell people that if they have aphids and they don't want to treat with a pesticide, they should just take a strong spray of hose water and spray them off, and they'll fall off. But you just said they're going to get back on the plant. So it's just something that you would do regularly, maybe spray off your plants.
Yeah. So when you're dealing with aphids, like in the home garden or on a house plant, in my opinion, monitoring is really important. They're small. They like those crevices of the plants. So hosing off does work really well because they're going to drown in the water. I mean, they're so small that they're going to get suspended in those droplets and they'll drown. But one spray...
Does that make you sad? I feel like you're getting a little sad.
No,
okay.
As entomologists, it's so weird because we love insects, but then, like, all the jobs for being an entomologist depend on killing the insects, you know?
Yeah, it's true. Yes, that's difficult.
But when you want to control aphids, like, one spray is not going to do it. Like, go out day after day because they're small and, like, some aphids, like, 2 to 14 days. Like, that's the lifespan of a single aphid.
Okay. And they're a really soft body. Like, if you touch them, like, they just kind of explode. Like, they're really small.
They're a soft body.
Okay.
So squishing... Like, if it's a small plant, squishing is an appropriate control method.
Oh, okay.
If it's small. I mean, if you have a huge plant.
Do they have big aphids?
You do have big aphids. Look up giant bark aphids.
Okay.
Because the first time I saw them, I was just amazed. They're like the size of a pea.
Where do you find them?
So there's different species, but a lot of them are associated with trees.
Do we have them in the United States?
We do.
I guess the most common aphid that I see are the oleander aphids, the yellow ones on the milkweed, because we're all grown milkweed for the monarchs. Mm-hmm. And people freak out because they see all these aphids. They may spray them off once. They always come back. And I see, like, aphids of all sizes, aphids pooping out aphids, and then some of them have wings and some of them don't. And I don't really get, is the ones with the wings the adults?
Not necessarily. So all winged aphids are adults. But most adult aphids do not have wings. So how it kind of works in general, because there are a lot of different species of aphids that do a lot of different things, is that aphids will reproduce parthenogenically. So you are a strong, independent female. You don't need a man. You're just going to pop out clones of yourselves, like little baby girls. Those baby girls are going to have more baby girls. That's like a whole other can of worms. But so that's how aphids reproduce, parthenogenically or asexually. So they're just, you know, and that's why aphids are so successful, is they don't need to mate. They're just making copies of themselves, and they do it really fast. So they can build up populations really fast.
Okay, so they do, like, explode. Like, so when people are like, I just did this, and they just popped up overnight. Yes. They really, truly they do. Did.
Yeah, especially with the oleander aphids. I've seen it on milkweed, like, one mm-hmm. day. There's nothing on the milkweed. The next day, it's covered in these yellow and black bugs.
Right.
But because they make such high populations so fast, there's this, it stresses out the plant. There's this trigger within the aphid that, like, I can tell this plant is stressed. There's too many of us. Then they will start producing winged females. And then those winged aphids, their job is to migrate to other plants, to spread out. So that is one way we have winged aphids.
Whoa.
There's this really, like, elaborate communication between the plant and the insect. It's all relying on, like, pheromones, chemical cues. So that's one way we have winged aphids. They're just meant to migrate to other places.
Are there male aphids?
There are.
What?
I know, it's so weird. So, like soybean aphids, they're a specialist. They feed on soybean as their secondary host, but their primary host is buckthorn.
A tree.
A tree, yes. And so that's the plant they overwinter on, which is why it's their primary host. And so the end of the season in the fall, once again, like taking cues from the plant and cues from the weather, these aphids will start producing winged females, but they'll also start producing winged males. And they will go and find buckthorn. The males will find the females. So then these winged aphids do mate, and they do have sexual reproduction. And then the female will lay the eggs that will overwinter.
On the buckthorn.
On the buckthorn.
But when you say they produce males, they produce little ones, and do they molt into...
Yep.
Okay, so they don't produce, like, adult males all of a sudden.
No. So they'll, like, give live birth to little baby aphids, and those aphids will grow up.
It's kind of ingrained in them that they will grow up to be winged males.
Correct.
Because she can decide that.
Yes. I mean, it's crazy.
It is crazy.
You wouldn't think, just looking at this tiny bug, like, hey, you're pretty smart.
No. And, like, I feel like I'm always like, oh, those are aphids. And then I'm like, are those aphids? And then I zoom in, I see the cornicles, I'm like, those are aphids. Mm-hmm. But then, for, like, let's say for soybean aphid, you have to have buckthorn then? Like, could you have an infestation in the soybean field if there were no buckthorn?
I mean, you could, because you think you have the winged migrants. That would be coming.
How far can they even fly?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
Like, they're so little. Are they good flyers, or do they just, like, blow in the wind?
Mostly blow in the wind. They rely a lot on wind.
I mean, it's Nebraska, right? I just don't even know how you could even...
I don't know how they could avoid blowing in the wind, you know? Like, some days I can't avoid
exactly.
blowing in the wind here.
Exactly.
But, yeah.
Hmm.
So, like, that's, like, when we think of management, we know buckthorn is their primary host. So if you have buckthorn trees bordering your soybean field, that's probably not a good
idea.
Thing.
Are there other aphids that feed on soybean, or only soybean aphid?
To my knowledge, it's only in the United States soybean aphid.
Okay. So we always get, like, there is aphids on my hibiscus, and then usually it's because the hibiscus was outside all summer and then they brought it in.
Mm-hmm.
So is that like a hibiscus aphid? Is that like a summer potted plant aphid? Like, how do people stop doing that? I would say if there's any homeowner houseplant people that do that, like, what could they do for that?
So I think whenever you bring a plant inside, like, regardless if you're worried about aphids or not, you just need to check it over for insects, because there's aphids, there's scales, there's white flies, there's
grasshoppers
spider mites,
in the soil.
There's grasshoppers in the soil. There's sometimes wasp nests that you don't see. And when you bring them into, like, the home environment, they're not going to have that winter pressure. They've got an abundance of food. They're and you're probably not looking at it every single day. So there's going to be like, hey, I'm bringing this plant in. It looks pretty healthy. Suddenly, like, oh, wait, it's turning yellow. And then you take a closer look.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, there's something on it. So regardless if it's aphids or not, you should always check your plants before you bring them inside.
Those are really good tips. And how do you know? There's other houseplant pests, though, too, that mm-hmm. often get confused. If I didn't have the cornicles to see, they could be, like, scales or white flies.
Yeah.
Do you have a good tip on telling those apart when you're looking at them?
Yeah, so they're really closely related.
And oh, okay.
So from an entomologist standpoint, like, I look at it, it's like, yeah, that's a white fly. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. How could you be confused? But I understand that everybody has seen white flies or aphids in their life. So they probably will just think it's just one of them. So scales, most of the time when you see a scale, it's going to be stuck to the plant. You can scrape it off. It's not going to be moving. A lot of aphids, they're kind of stationary, but you disturb them, they will move. White flies, the adults are obviously white and they can fly, which scales and most aphids cannot. Hmm. But like, if you're curious, get it identified. That's what you and I are here for, Jody.
True.
Like summertime, half of our requests are for like landscape plant pests.
It's true. Feel like. If there wasn't a picture though, are aphids known for having like all those little white exoskeletons, right?
Yes.
Is that one of those characteristics too?
I wouldn't rely on that personally. I don't know. We don't really see the exoskeleton with scales, but I've seen it with white flies. And so it's okay. Not like if you see an exoskeleton, that's immediately what it's going to be. It's always most reliable if you can see the actual insect itself.
And then if their plants are sticky?
Yes. So that's the honeydew again. That's like the pure sugar that they're secreting. And so if you don't have ants to eat it up, it's just going to stay on the leaf and it's going to get sticky. Sometimes it gets moldy.
Oh.
Too.
The city mold,
yeah. But the good thing is all of those are sucking insects, piercing sucking insects. So a lot of the control methods are going to be pretty similar.
What would those be?
So in the context of like houseplants...
I've heard you can shower with your plants.
You can.
That's weird. Is that weird?
Yeah, you can rinse them off in the sink. But once again, it's like they're small. They hide mm-hmm. in like the crevices. So one rinse isn't going to do it. You need to stay on top of it. There is a point, I would say, where it might just be easier to like give up. Like, wow, I've got hundreds of aphids on this plant. Like, I might just want to check it.
Have you ever had a plant that's like that?
Yes.
Oh.
I don't remember what type of plant it was, but it was in the office. And one day I looked at it. It's like, wow, this is covered in hundreds of aphids. And I tried the rinsing water thing, and there was just too much aphid pressure. And I was like, before these get to the other plants, I'm just going to kill off this one.
Because if it was a general, those ones would spread to the other plants.
Yeah. Most of the time with houseplants, it's going to be one that can spread.
These are all good tips because I would say, like, of anything that has to do with aphids, it's the questions during the winter of people's houseplants not looking so mm-hmm. good. And then they're like, I just noticed them.
Right, yeah. People don't notice until their plant looks sick. Like, the aphids have probably been there a long time.
I mean, I love ants. That's not a secret. But are ants good for aphids then or bad for aphids?
They're good for the aphids. They're bad for the plant in a roundabout way. So what happens is the aphids are feeding on the plant. They're hurting the plant. Same time, they're making honeydew. And ants love honeydew. It's really nutritious for them. So they will farm, quote unquote, aphids. So they'll live around the aphids, they'll take the honeydew, have a nice meal, and then they'll protect the aphids from predators like lady beetles or lacewings. So the aphids love the ants. The ants rely on the aphids rely on the ants, but in a roundabout way, the ants being there might not be so good for the plant because it's protecting them against beneficial predators.
Hmm. For me, it's a sign that there's aphids when I see the ants because mm-hmm. You know, you probably would see the aphids first and I would see the ants or whatever
yeah.
growing somewhere.
Yeah.
Is it like nature's like tarot bait or something like that? Like, because a lot of ants don't come in the house to feed. They are not I guess, eating our drips or whatever like that, because there's so many aphids or plant feeders that they feed on. Like, so ants that live outside, do they probably need aphids?
Yeah. If there's an abundance of food, like, and there's no food inside, why would you ruin a good thing?
Yeah. Do you know about root aphids? Because there's some ants that farm them.
Yes. So aphids will feed on like every single part of the plant. So a lot of times you can see aphids on like flower petals too, mm-hmm. which is why systemics don't always work because flower petals don't take up the systemic very well.
Saw them on columbine last week, and I've seen mm-hmm. them on iris.
Yep. And then there's certain species of aphids that actually live in the ground and feed on the roots too. And ants like citronella ants,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Those are the ones I see.
They farm root aphids.
And when I like flip over a rock or something and they're under there, they like will pick them up and carry them around. It's so cute.
I can't say I've ever seen that myself. Next time, take a video.
And then the other aphid I wanted to ask you about was like the ones that are just like floating around, like the woolly aphids or something.
Oh, the woolly aphids, the waxy aphids.
What is that?
So a lot of like scale insects will also get really waxy. Some leafhoppers will get really waxy. And there's aphids that get really waxy. And we call them woolly aphids because this wax is like little white tendrils that make them look fuzzy and woolly. And it's really to kind of protect the aphids a little bit. Huh. But then you see them floating and it's almost like a tiny little cotton seed or something, but it's like a little aphid. They're super cute.
We get calls about like, there's this tiny floaty white thing. And I mean, there are some people that see floaty white things and they're not aphids, mm-hmm. but sometimes they really are floaty white aphids. But then if you find the tree that they're on, they're like these brown aphids all stuck to the tree with like wax coming out of their butts.
Yeah. And it's, if you see videos, like, where you see a bunch of them together on mm-hmm. the tree and you disturb them, then all of a sudden these, like, little waxy butts start wiggling.
They do
and they're
dance.
Like, hey, yes.
They twerk.
That's their, like, alarm signal. Like, oh, something's after us. It's really adorable.
The twerking aphids on a twig. Are aphids gall makers? Like, there's
not all aphids, okay. but there are specific ones. I can't think of the names off the top of my head because we kind of get in our own like little.
Well, there's 5,000 of them. You can't know all of them.
But there are, and I mean, galls are just like a plant's overreaction to an insect.
Okay, so then it would be in there, so no ants could have the honeydew from that because it's making that plant develop
the plant
that
will go
thing.
Around mm-hmm. the aphid.
You know a lot about aphids.
I love them. And this is so amazing because,
And I didn't even know you knew so much about aphids. Like, I'm pretty excited.
I'm excited, too, because, like, I talk about bed bugs all day and cockroaches all day. And then, like, when we did Master Gardener training earlier this year, it's like, oh, my gosh, I get to talk about landscape IPM. And I get to talk about host plant resistance? What? And so I probably spent a little too long on host plant resistance.
I think it shows also that, I mean, we sometimes study things that we won't be really talking about or doing on a daily basis, mm-hmm. I guess. Like, I mean, what do you think of being an urban entomologist? Like, are you like, bed bugs, roaches, ants is so boring?
No, I honestly, like, I find them fascinating. In grad school, like, I was really heavy into the research, but in my free time, I was really heavy into outreach, like, mostly with schools, elementary school, high school, different things like that. And I think that's where I really found my passion. So when I saw an opening at the University of Nebraska for an extension entomologist, I was like, you know what? I don't know a whole lot about urban things, but I'm going to try it because that's science communication. And I mean, IPM can be used for all sorts of pests. So lessons I learned about IPM for aphids can be translated to IPM for bed bugs. And that's pretty much, I mean, the lesson is like, there's no one tactic that's going to work.
Right. And because you're a good communicator, you're just good at what you do when you have a lot of the skill set that you have that you could adapt to any system.
Yeah, it's pretty adaptable. Thank you, by the way.
I mean, if you need words of affirmation, I can give you one every day. I am so lucky to be able to work with you. I honestly don't think this job is for everyone. I love it, but there are a lot of parts, like every job, that are difficult. And it's not about dealing with bugs all the time. We deal with people, and we deal with some very tough situations. And so I think it has to be about just like persisting and knowing, like a lot of it has to be internally driven.
I agree with you. I think when you work in extension and you work with the public, you have to be really passionate about what you do. Because like you said, there are definitely challenges with the public. Communicating to them is different than like we're at a conference. Communicating to our fellow entomologists about bugs is totally different. But which is why having you is so nice. Like I said, we can share the struggles because it's not always rainbows. We deal with clients that are often, you know, bed bugs are frustrating and it is a very emotional topic for a lot of people.
It's not a 5-minute call of spray it off with water.
Right. And you know, like people do get emotional. I've had people crying and it's tough and we have to be able to relate to that, but we also have to be like, you know, factful. Is that a word?
In my head, I'm just like, the mission of Extension is to be there for the people, to provide the information so that they can make those decisions on their own. Like, I can't tell them what to do. Do you think as a grad student, you knew and understood extension and what that was? Because I think when we go into entomology and we start doing grad school, a lot of us think we're going to be like a researcher or be a professor and be in academia or work for industry.
Right.
Is there something that you wanted to do when you started off?
So I always wanted to be a professor. I had a really great undergraduate and graduate advisor who I just really looked up to. Like, she taught classes. Like, I want to be her one day. And that's kind of still true. Like, part of me wants to get back into the classroom. And, you know, not to, like, knock on graduate programs, but going through it, I can honestly say I wasn't exposed to extension very much. I did a lot of outreach, but did I work with, like, specific clients or, like, pest management professionals? No.
Did you know what the difference between outreach and extension is? Because some people still don't know until you're in extension and you see the differences.
I actually made that mistake once. As a graduate student, I was talking to the insect diagnostician at the time in the department, and I had used extension, like, I'm going on an extension thing at a school today. And they're like, what are you doing? And they, like, and it made me realize, like, no, what I'm doing is outreach. And so there is a distinction, and, you know, a lot of times there is overlap. But I think if there's an opportunity to expose graduate students to extension, because, like you said, it's usually all research, sometimes they'll TA. Because, I mean, where would, not to, like, tout extension too much, like, but where would the world be without extension? You know, research is creating all of these new products and these techniques, but if nobody adapts it, you know, that's our job, is to help the public adapt these different things.
Right. How to use the research in applicable ways.
Right.
Because we don't tell them, like, hey, read that peer-reviewed paper and use it as a sleep aid, and then you want to understand
it. Like, how it would probably get, like, misinterpreted.
Yeah. Did you always want to be an entomologist?
I always wanted to work with animals. In high school, I did the Zoo Academy program at Omaha's Henry Doorly Zoo.
Did you grow up in Omaha?
I'm Big City, Nebraska. I like to make the distinction because a lot of people, when they think Nebraska, they think like farmland and things like that. But yeah, so I grew up in Papillion. I did the program at the zoo and I worked with monkeys most of the time. They're called owl monkeys. They're these small little monkeys with these big, because they're nocturnal, these big eyes. And I actually worked on training them.
What did you train them to do?
So if you've ever, like, trained a dog.
Oh, my gosh.
The clicker. So I clicker trained them. And then I target trained them to, like, touch the end, like, a red ball on the end of a stick.
Do they get treats?
They do. They get mealworms. Mealworms and bananas were their favorite. And then, like, teaching them to, like, walk over to a certain place to touch a ball, you can get them on the scale with, like, a weighing scale without touching them, because there's always risk with wild animals. Like, you don't want to touch them because it'll stress them. You could hurt yourself in the process. So, like, making, like, vet appointments easier. That was... So in that journey, I was like, wow, I really love animals. I really love zoology, but I cry a lot. I don't want to put animals down. Aww. I don't want to work with sick animals. And then I interned in the butterfly house. It's like, I think I can deal with bugs dying. Like, like, I'm still working with animals, but I'm not going to cry over this walking stick passing away. Does that make me seem like a little callous a little bit? It's just kind of, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was like, this is a happy medium. I'm going to go into entomology. And that's where I met my undergraduate advisor. And like I said, she was the one that really inspired me to continue the entomology route.
That's good. Well, I'm happy. I'm happy for her and you. Did your family, were they supportive of your entomology quest?
I think so. Like, I have two kids now. And, like, I always remember the first one. Like, every baby gift I got was bug-themed. Like, a bug-themed onesie. Like, a bumblebee toy. So I think, you know, they really... It's so unique being an entomologist that I feel like our parents are, like, really excited about that. Because it's not kind of a run-of-the-mill job.
True. I mean, it's weird. Like, I always say there's, like, entomologists and then maybe there's, like, normal people.
Well, like, last night, you know, we were out eating and a group of five entomologists. And at one point, like, everyone's got their phone out and we're just showing each other pictures of bugs that we found. And I don't know if you can really do that with non-entomologists.
Yeah, it probably wouldn't be appropriate, except in this setting, it was appropriate. Like, right. I don't even know.
Like, could you, like, pull out a picture of an engorged tick?
I don't, like, was hey, that what I was doing? I was like, I don't even know which one I was showing yesterday. You're a mom, so you've got two little cute, adorable boys. I always think they should do, I don't know who they are, an experiment or follow children of entomologists to see what their views about nature or the natural world or insects are, because I think they're not going to be quote unquote normal either. They just think they're entomologists.
And, you know, my son is kind of a mixed bag because my husband doesn't appreciate anything with more than four legs being indoors.
Oh,
we're working on it. But yeah, so when kids see their parents freak out about a spider, they're going to freak out about a spider. It cracks me up because since preschool, you know, a lot of times when I pick them up, it's like, oh, they were out looking for roly-polies again today, because my son loves roly-polies. And oftentimes he'll tell me an insect fact and that he kind of pulls out of the air, and I'll correct him, and he'll argue with me about it. And I'll be like, who's the bug expert here? And he's like, we both are.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, you know, I'll take it.
Yeah.
But yeah, they learn from their parents. With your daughter being the age that she is, does she ever think, like, oh, my mom's not cool anymore? Like, bugs aren't cool?
I don't know. I've never asked her.
I can kind of imagine that.
Yeah. Well, you know what? She's at the age where nothing I do is cool, so I don't think that makes it any different. Is there anything else you want to talk about aphids? Like, I just asked all, like, the random questions, but I need to know more.
We didn't talk about that you have to talk about with aphids. Telescoping. Generations.
Is that the I'm pregnant with your grand?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell I'm us all pregnant, about that.
But the baby inside of me is also pregnant.
Wait. No.
I never thought like
And that's called what?
It's called telescoping generations, because it's like you have your telescope all together
and
then you whoop pull it apart and it gets longer. Like it's kind of like Russian nesting dolls. So because aphids can reproduce without a man asexually, and they just pop out clones of themselves, you can have one aphid and she will be pregnant with an aphid. And sometimes depending on the species, you can see the baby's eyes through the mom's exoskeleton. It's really freaky.
Wait, but like, are they, they're not mature then?
They're not mature.
What?
So she will have a baby inside of her, and that baby will already have another baby. And that's how fast they reproduce. So she needs to be an adult to give birth to the baby.
But how do they determine? So is it that point? Like, when does it they determine, like, when it's going to be a male, though? So those are all going to be females,
right?
Once again,
that's, like, the cues from their environment. The cues from
So that baby could be a male? Or not?
No.
Okay. Oh, my gosh.
No. So when they have the telescoping generations, they're going to be females.
It's the cloning.
Like I said, look up like pictures of aphids where you can see the baby eyes through their back and their exoskeleton. It's so weird. Insects are so weird.
Is it all aphids? Most aphids?
Most aphids. I don't want to say all because I don't know.
Yeah, no, you can't ever say that.
But like the green peach aphid, you can clearly see the red of the baby's eyes.
How can you tell the difference between aphids? Is it color, size? It's like, you know, like for ants, it's like the nodes. It's like how many nodes? It's like this shape. Like, are they, because they all look like these little poofy things with cornicles.
No? So sometimes it's easy first just like knowing what the host plant is. If you know what plant they're feeding
on, host plant.
That will narrow it down. Like if I know it was found in Nebraska.
Yeah. So someone brought you a baggie with like one aphid because you know it happens. And they were like, what kind of aphid is this?
You know, it's funny because I have
a
fellow grad student in my lab. That was one of his candidacy questions. They were given a single aphid and they had to identify it down to species without any context. And I just remember him struggling because there's, I mean, green peach aphids probably look like soybean aphids. I think I can kind of tell the difference, but.
I know, like, I've seen a red aphid. I've seen black aphids on sunflower. I've seen red aphids on fake sunflower, maybe. I've seen oleander aphids, woolly aphids. Like,
sometimes it's like the length of the cornicle. Sometimes it's the position of the cornicle. But like I said, if you know the host plant, you can probably narrow it down at the very least. So you had mentioned that there's a lot of things that like to eat aphids.
Yes.
So I think the most classic are lady beetles, like the grouchy ladybug. Have you read that book?
Yeah.
It's kind of not a great book.
He's very angry.
He's very grouchy. But you know what? He shares at the end. I think that's the moral of the story. Oh. But he wants all of these aphids.
Is he the one who yells at the whale?
Yes! He's so mad that he just yells at the whale. But in the end, he eats aphids, and I think he was just hangry the whole time.
Well, why are we talking about grouchy ladybug?
But anyways, a lot of things like to eat... Oh gosh, I'm so confused.
Aphids.
A lot of things like to eat aphids. Including... parasitic wasps, these little tiny wasps. You know, people think of wasps, they think paper wasps, they think yellow jackets, but they're these little tiny parasitic wasps, and they inject their egg inside the aphid. The egg hatches, and these aphids are pretty much eaten from the inside out. And so a lot of times, especially on like the oleander aphids on milkweed, you'll see these bright yellow aphids, you'll see the white cast exoskeletons, but you also see some brown aphids.
I've seen some like bronzy ones, mm-hmm. and then black ones too.
So the black ones are aphids that currently have the wasp inside them eating them.
And other ones, like they have a hole, like it's bursted out.
Yeah. And so the brown ones are the mummies where there's nothing left inside of them. It was a delicious treat. They're dead. They're just hanging out. And then there's a hole where the wasp came out. Those are the aphid mummies.
I guess we could wrap up if you're all aphided out.
I kind of am.
Okay. I want to thank you, Kate, for letting me interview you. Actually looking like face-to-face giggling. This is like a huge treat for me because even with John and Mike, we're all on Zoom all the time. Where can our listeners go to find you and some of your work?
As I mentioned, I'm an extension educator at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. I'm located in Lincoln, Nebraska at our Lancaster County office. But you can find me mostly on Twitter, at Kate Chapman UNL. Bear in mind that I do not spell my name traditionally, so it's at KaitChapmanUNL.
Cool. To all our listeners, you can find our podcast on any podcatcher app. You can find our show notes on arthro-pod@blogspot.com. You can find us on Twitter at @arthro_pod show. And you can find me on Twitter at @JodyBugsMeUNL. I try to post pictures of what's going on in Nebraska when I can find the time. We will be catching up with you guys a bit later, and Mike and John will be back. So join us again for another episode of Arthro Pod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time. Same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthro Pod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
Did you ever do a talk on like the cutest insects?
I gave a talk on arthropods have talent.
Okay.
I don't think I included cutest insects.
I did see a cicada once, like a newly like emerged cicada. Oh my god, it was so cute. And it's like eyes are so far apart and it like had one like one leg up and I was like cutest.
Ugly cute. Like you
like
know,
a pug?
Like a pug. Or like those cats with the flat faces. Like but like bee flies.
Oh, bee flies are cute. No, the cutest is the trash bugs. When they've got the trash on their backs, that's the cutest.
Put that in the ugly cute category.
If the listeners would like a presentation on the cutest, random, ugly, cute things, reach out. We'll put one together.